Well, we come this week to our final passage in the book of Genesis. So chapters 46 through 50. And this is going to be the final story in the first book of the Bible. And you know, we've looked at this, but most of this book has been following members of this one family, the family of Abraham. So we followed the story of Abraham, and then his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob, and ending with Jacob's son Joseph, who we looked at last week, and who we conclude our study in Genesis looking at this week. And remember, last week, God had worked through Joseph to predict that this famine was coming, that would last 7 years in this region of the world. And because Joseph knew it was coming, he worked for Pharaoh to store up enough food to last through those 7 years. And God put Joseph in that spot of authority so that Joseph could save his family. God was doing what he's been doing throughout Genesis. He was preserving Israel. He was preserving this one family, this one group of people. But last week, you remember, our story ended with Joseph's 11 brothers with him, safe in Egypt. But his dad, Jacob, hadn't yet come. And that's where our story picks up this morning. So look at chapter 46, verse 1. This is the word of the Lord. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba. Remember, Israel is the new name that God has given to Jacob. So sometimes he's referred to as Jacob, sometimes he's referred to as Israel. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." Well, God is telling Jacob here that he doesn't have anything to be afraid of by having to leave his home and go down to Egypt. God is going to continue looking out for him and his family. And God is calling Jacob's memory back to these promises that he's been making to the family of Israel for four generations now. And that's what we're going to look at this morning. So these final chapters in Genesis, they're calling us to look back at the entire book of Genesis to see where God has brought this family. So we're going to look at two parts of that this morning. We're going to look at what Genesis has told us about the covenant maker, who is God. And second, we're going to look at the details of the covenant, how God has been fulfilling these promises throughout Genesis. So look at verse 3 again of chapter 46. "Then he said, 'I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation.'" Well, the first thing God says, you know, when he says, "I am God, the God of your father," that's usually the way that God leads into making a promise to someone. Or the word that the Bible uses to talk about the most serious promise you can make, a covenant. And typically, when God's about to make a covenant, he leads with this statement about who he is. Listen to how he does it with Abraham. Genesis chapter 17, verse 1, he does the same thing. "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly." Well, it's significant that in these contexts, God doesn't just shoot right into the specific promises that he's making to Abraham and Jacob. He starts by reminding them about who he is. And I think God does this mainly to remind us that he has the power to actually fulfill the promise that he's about to make. We've talked about this before, but in this season of presidential politics, every candidate is telling us 100 things they're going to do for the American people in the first year or in their first month or even their first day. But of course, the problem is our form of government doesn't just include an executive branch. It also includes a judiciary and a legislature. So the president has to work with other groups to get things done. So when you hear a candidate make promises, you've got to wonder, you know, can he or she actually make that happen? They've got to work with other people. You know, they don't have that kind of unilateral power. So can they actually do this thing they're promising me that they can do? But what we have to remember is that when God prefaces his promises with, "I'm God," he's reminding us that he doesn't have to work with other groups to make things happen. God's government is a monarchy. He's the king. He doesn't have to rely on anybody else. He doesn't have to get approval from a group. He does everything on his own. He has unilateral authority. And because of that, he can always fulfill his word. Listen to this from Psalm 89. This is what it says, Psalm 89, verses 34 through 35. God says, I will not violate my covenant or alter the word that went forth from my lips. Once for all, I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie. God always fulfills his promises. And God reminds us of this in the following verses of chapter 46. So when God tells Jacob not to be afraid to travel down to Egypt, he says he's going to continue to take care of him. Look at what the text says immediately following that. Verse 5 of chapter 46. Then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they had gained in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt. Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his offspring he brought with him into Egypt. So the Lord is telling Jacob to trust that he'll continue to look out for him and for his family. And if they're starting to doubt that, they can just look at all this stuff that they're having to carry down to Egypt. All these flocks and all these children, these are tangible ways that they can see God's faithfulness. God has been taking care of them the entire time, and he will continue to take care of them. And this part of our passage, it should remind us to do that same thing. So when we're fearful as Christians about whether God is really in control or whether he's really working good in our life, even in the midst of trouble, we just need to look back at our life so far. God has always been faithful to you, right? King David says this in Psalm chapter 37, verse 25. He says, I have been young and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken. That's a great verse, isn't it? He says, I have been young and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken. If you think about it, as a Christian, that's your experience too. God has always ultimately taken care of you. So use that history of faithfulness to fuel your trust in the Lord for the future. It's part of what we're reminded here. And after going through the entire book of Genesis, we've seen this over and over again, haven't we? Because not only does God not need anyone else's help to accomplish his plans, but most of Genesis is him preserving his plans in spite of everyone else. So it's almost like all these other humans are working against his plans, but he continues to fulfill them. He continues to accomplish his purposes. So he preserves Abraham and Sarah, even though Abraham gives his wife to other men twice. God produces Isaac, their son, even though Abraham and Sarah have Abraham sleeping with other women to try to get them pregnant because Sarah is barren. But still God produces Isaac. God protects Jacob when his brother Esau is trying to kill him. And of course, a few weeks ago, we saw him protect Joseph and put him in a position of power where he could then protect his family. One of the last notes in the book of Genesis is chapter 50, verse 20. We looked at this verse last week. This is Joseph summing up sort of all of the bad experiences of his life. His brothers are still feeling guilt for selling him into slavery all those years before. And this is what Joseph says about all the tough experiences in his life. Chapter 50, verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. That's what Joseph understood. And that's part of the message of Genesis. God's plans will never be pushed off course, even an inch. He always fulfills his promises. That's one of the main messages of the book of Genesis. And that's because of who the covenant maker is. But Genesis doesn't just focus on the character of the covenant maker. Genesis also focuses on the content of the covenant. So what the particular promises of this covenant are. Look at chapter 46, verse 3 again. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. The promise that God makes to Jacob in these opening verses of chapter 46 are part of the covenant that he made to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. And that covenant has been repeated now to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob for 34 chapters. These same promises that God keeps coming back and reestablishing that started in chapter 12. And this covenant contains distinct promises, the same promises we've been talking about throughout our study of Genesis. And that's what the entire book is really about. God making and then beginning to fulfill these promises to his people. So in this covenant, God is promising to give Abraham and his offspring three things, these three distinct parts of the covenant. He promises to give them a father, second, a family, and third, a home. And we're going to finish up our study of this book by looking at these three promises. So first, a father. The first thing that God promises to his people in this covenant is, in fact, a father. Look again at chapter 46, verses 1 through 3. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "I am God, the God of your father." So in these opening verses, God is reminding Jacob that Jacob and God are in a relationship with one another. And it's the same relationship that Abraham was in with God. God is their father. That's what God is reminding Jacob of here. Humans are designed by God to know God. We are designed to be brought into a relationship where God is our father. A pastor in the 5th century named Augustine said it this way. He said, "Thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee." That's a good way to say it, isn't it? Thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee. Recently, one of the pastors here, Galen, was telling me about how he goes hunting with his dog. He has this beagle named Kirby, and he'll go hunt rabbits, and he'll take Kirby with him. And I was asking about that process and asking if he had to train Kirby to do that. And he said that he didn't. That's just how beagles are. That's built into them. That's what they were created for. So when they get out there and they see those rabbits, they know what they're supposed to do. Well, that's like what human beings are supposed to be like. We're created to love the Lord, to be plugged into our relationship with him, where he is our father and we are his children. We were created for that. But the challenge that the Bible reveals to us is that no one knows God on their own naturally. And in fact, on our own, left alone, our natural state, nobody actually wants to know the Lord. This is what it says in Romans 3. There it tells us, no one seeks for God. No one seeks for God. This is what it says in 1 Corinthians 2. Paul there says, the natural person, so that's the person who the Holy Spirit hasn't tampered with them yet. The Holy Spirit hasn't yet opened their eyes, opened their heart. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he is not able to understand them. So in our natural state as humans, we don't want God as our father. Adam and Eve were the last humans like us, the last mere humans. Of course, the exception there is Jesus Christ, who was fully human but also fully God. Adam and Eve were the last mere humans who had God as their father. Once they brought sin into the world, then every human after Adam and Eve was born with a sinful nature. And that means that you and me were born into a situation where God was not our father, where we were alienated from him. In fact, Jesus says it this way. In John 8, Jesus says, "You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires." As humans, we are born into a situation where we are estranged and alienated from God. So that's why in Genesis 12, God has to go and find Abraham. He has to go and get him because Abraham isn't looking for the Lord. And in fact, we're told that Abraham was worshiping fake gods. So not only was he not looking for the real God, he was satisfied to worship idols, these false gods. And that's because Abraham was just like every other human being born into sin. He wasn't interested in the real God. He was satisfied without God. But despite that, listen to what God tells Abraham. This is from Genesis chapter 17. He says, "And I will establish my covenant between me and you." God is giving himself to Abraham as a father. But the question for us is, well, how is that relationship going to be kept up? How is that relationship going to be sustained? Because the thing is, Genesis 3 through 11 is just story after story of man's hopeless sinfulness. That man is hopelessly sinful. And God's a good God. He has to punish sin. That's the refrain of Genesis 3 through 11. And the culmination of that is the flood, where God has to flood the entire earth to get rid of every family except for one, to judge them for their sin. And even that one family, once the ark stops and they can get off it, they sin. Noah gets drunk. His sons act shamefully. So Genesis 3 through 11 is all about man's sin. Here in Genesis 12, God says he's going to give himself to Abraham as a father, but how will that relationship be sustained? Well, let's flip back to Genesis 15 to be reminded. Because in Genesis 15, there's a record of a religious ceremony between Abraham and God. And in this culture, when two people were making a covenant with one another, they would go through this ceremony. And here's how it goes. We've talked about this before, but good to be reminded. When two people wanted to make a covenant with one another, a promise to one another, they would take a bunch of animals and they'd cut them in half. And they'd lay the different halves of the animals on opposite sides of one another. And then the two people making the covenant would walk, both of them, side by side, between the animal pieces. And here's what they were saying when they took part in this ceremony. They were saying, "If I break my part of the covenant, may what happened to these animals happen to me." So they were saying, "I'm welcoming death on myself if I break my part of this deal." And in fact, in verse 18 of chapter 15, when it says God made a covenant with Abram, the Hebrew word that's translated "made" actually means to cut. And that's the verb that everyone used for making a covenant. You cut a covenant. And they said that because of this ceremony where the animals were cut in half. So in Genesis 15, Abraham prepares these animals for this ceremony where he and God are going to walk between them to make this covenant. But then a really surprising thing happens. Look at verse 12. "As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him." So God puts Abraham to sleep. But why does he put him to sleep here? You know, in particular, why put him to sleep right before they're about to take part in this covenant ceremony? Well, it turns out that God puts him to sleep exactly because they were about to take part in this ceremony. Look at verse 17. "When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram." Well, this smoking fire and flaming torch, that's representative of the Lord's presence. So what we've got in the story is he puts Abraham to sleep, and then God passes between those animal pieces. And once God has passed between them, look again at what he says, verse 18. "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham." God put Abraham to sleep because God wanted to establish this covenant by himself. It's a one-sided covenant that makes God Abraham's father. And he shows this by walking through these animal pieces alone. So God is taking the responsibility of both parties to this covenant on himself. He's saying that if he breaks his end of the promise, then he'll bear the punishment for that. But he's also saying that if Abraham breaks his end of the promise, if Abraham is unfaithful to the covenant, then God will bear punishment for that too. This is a one-sided contract. And that's the only reason that this father-son relationship is sustainable, is because God is taking the requirements of both parties on himself. And of course, this is fulfilled in the cross of Jesus Christ. Abraham was a covenant breaker in the same way that you and me are covenant breakers. Every time we sin in our life, that's us breaking the covenant with our Creator who created us to glorify Him. We've broken our end of the deal. But that's why God bears the penalty for our sin through the cross. That's why Jesus came. Jesus lived the life that you should have lived, and He died the death that you should have died. And He paid the penalty for our having broken the covenant. That's how Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and you get a father. And that's the first promise in this covenant. But that's not the only promise that God makes in this covenant. He also promises Abraham a family. So part of the covenant is He promises Abraham a father, but the second part is He promises him a family. Flip back over to chapter 46, to our passage this morning. Look at verse 3 again. God tells Jacob, "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation." So God is reminding Jacob of the promise He's been making to him his entire life, and making to his father before him, and to Abraham before him, that He's not just going to preserve individual Israelites, but in fact, he's going to make them into a huge family, a family big enough to be a nation. This is what He tells Abraham in chapter 15, verse 5 about this family. "And God brought Abram outside and said, 'Look toward heaven and number the stars. If you are able to number them,' then He said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.'" So God tells Abraham that He's going to give him a family that's so big that if you're just sitting down and trying to count them, they seem innumerable. And God is reminding Jacob about this part of the covenant in chapter 46. You will be given a family. And for us as Christians, family is part of the good news of Christianity. It's part of what's promised us. So He doesn't just save us as individuals and then let us walk this life alone. He saves us into a family. God saves us into a church. And that's why throughout the Old Testament, we see God doing this with Israel, that He's growing them. He grows them into a family. He preserves them. That's what we saw with the story of Joseph. When he brings his brothers back, he's keeping the line safe. And He also sets them apart. So look at chapter 46, verse 33. This is what He does with this family. He wants to make it clear who's a part of the family. "So when Joseph's father and brothers, when they're coming back to Egypt, Joseph coaches them on what to tell Pharaoh." Look at this, chapter 46, verse 33. "When Pharaoh calls you and says, 'What is your occupation?' you shall say, 'Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians.'" So for whatever reason, the Egyptians didn't like shepherds. So what Joseph says is, "Hey, listen, tell him that you've been shepherds," which is true, "and they'll let you settle in sort of the outskirts of town." And that's what Joseph wanted to have happen. That's because God wants to keep His people separate. He wants the world to be able to see who are a part of His people. And He wants God's people to know who are their family. So that's part of what He does here. That's why we have circumcision in the Old Testament. That was a big part of the way where Old Testament Israel was supposed to be separate from the other nations. That was a tangible thing that set them apart. They were the only ones that did that in this culture. And of course, when we get to the New Testament, the way that we're initially marked off from people in the New Testament is baptism. That's the thing that separates the people of God initially. It's sort of the initiatory rite of Christianity. It's a physical symbol that marks off God's people. And that's why when folks in Acts want to become Christians, that's the first thing that the pastors tell them to do is, okay, be baptized into Christ. And the thing they're baptized into is a family. So again, God doesn't just save us into a network of people. He saves us into a family. And there's a lot of passages in the New Testament that make this clear, but probably the most helpful one is in Acts chapter 2. So this is the first Christian church in Acts chapter 2 that's described. And listen to what it says they're doing as we think about this idea of Christians being saved into a family. This is Acts 2, verse 41 and following. This is what it says. "So those who received His word were baptized." So Peter's preaching the gospel. These people respond. They become Christians. "So those who received His word were baptized, and there were added that day about 3,000 souls." This is what they were doing as a church. "And they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread," which is talking about the Lord's Supper, "and the prayers. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. and they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts. So this is the first Christian church in history, and it's recorded as an example to us. And I mean, it's helpful to look at this passage every now and then. So it's Acts chapter 2, verse 41, if you want to look at it later. But the word it says there is they were devoting themselves to these things. The things that I just listed, they were devoting themselves to them. So they were devoting themselves to the preaching and teaching in their church. They were devoting themselves to taking the Lord's Supper together. They were devoting themselves to fellowship together, just spending time with one another. They were devoting themselves to praying for one another. So in short, they were devoting themselves to one another. That's the picture of the church that we're given here in Acts 2. And they were so devoted to one another that as individuals, they were selling their stuff to be able to provide for material needs inside the body. That's devotion, isn't it? That's the picture that we're given of a Christian being devoted to a church. Now, when we hear stuff like that, we could all think of 100 different obstacles to that in our lives. I could never be that devoted to a particular church because of all of these things. And that's natural. I mean, this is a busy life that we all find ourselves in. And we didn't choose this life. I mean, we're sort of in the middle of it. I mean, the way that parents around us do things, the activities their kids are involved in, the demands of work. I mean, none of that is something that any of us asked for. This is the culture that we find ourselves in. But this is what we need to remember. We can trust this. Whatever we would have to lose in our lives to be devoted to the church the way that these folks were, it'll be worth it. The benefit that we'll get from being plugged into a church and being devoted to that church the way that these Christians were in Acts, it'll be worth it. It'll be worth the sacrifice. We can trust that. So the Lord saves us into a family. But just like we're saved into a family, God was promising the same for Abraham. And that's the promise he's been working out throughout Genesis. He preserves their line, makes them into a big family. And that's what he's starting to do here. So look at chapter 46, verse 27. The second half is the last sentence in verse 27. All the persons in the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. So what started out with just one man, Abraham, has become 70 people. It's become a big family. And it's going to become even bigger. This is what it says at the beginning of Exodus, which is the next book right after Genesis. It says this in Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. So Israel's going to grow so big that the land is filled with them. And in fact, this is what leads to slavery in Egypt. So you know the story of the Exodus where Moses has to come in and the Lord uses him, let my people go, and Israel ends up coming out. The reason Pharaoh put them into slavery, into forced labor, is because they're so big that he's nervous that they could turn on Egypt. Egypt, the superpower of the world. And this is how big Israel has gotten at this point, that Pharaoh's intimidated. So God is fulfilling this promise to grow a family. So they get a father and a family, but the last thing they get is a home. So God's covenant includes the promise of a home. This is what he tells Abraham back in chapter 15, verse 18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. So God doesn't just promise him a family and a father, but also a home. He created us with bodies, and he creates a place for us to live. That's a requirement for us as humans, and it'll be a requirement in heaven. We're going to be given a place to live. And he does this in Genesis 1 and 2. This is what the Garden of Eden is. He created a perfect place for humans, but Adam and Eve bring sin into the world, and then they're ejected from that garden. They can't be in the Lord's presence anymore. They can't be in that perfect place when sin is there. Well, this is the promise that's been the least developed throughout Genesis. So they've got God as a father. They're starting to get a big family, but they really don't have a home yet. And in fact, they only have one piece of property in the promised land. It's a tomb that Abraham bought, that he's buried in. But look at what Jacob tells his family in chapter 49, verse 29. This is what Jacob says. He's getting old, and he says this to his family, chapter 49, verse 29. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my father in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. So they've got this tomb that they're going to continue burying the patriarchs in, but that's sort of a down payment. They trust that, okay, we've been given sort of a foothold in this land, and God's going to grow that and give us this home. This is what Joseph says to his brothers in chapter 50, verse 24. He says, I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And this is largely what the next six books of the Old Testament are going to be about, is fulfilling this promise, is giving Israel the promised land. He's going to continue to develop that. But one thing that we see is that when God makes this promise to Abraham for a home, the promise is actually bigger than even that piece of real estate in the Middle East that he marks off for him in the Old Testament. This is what it says in Romans chapter 4. It says, for the promise is to Abraham and his offspring that he would be heir of the world. So God starts by giving his people this piece of real estate in the Middle East, but Jesus eventually is going to be reigning over the world. And that's going to be our home, the new heavens and the new earth. But as we close, this home for Israel, it's not just a home. The way it's described most often is a kingdom. It's going to be a kingdom. And something that God's been making clear all throughout Genesis is to get into a kingdom, you have to have a king. And that's really the main message of Genesis. That's what it's leading up to, is that we need a king. We need somebody to bring us into this kingdom. It's in this passage that Jacob is blessing his sons before he dies in Genesis chapter 49. That's what chapter 49 is about. This is the last passage we're going to look at. It's chapter 49, verse 8. So basically, it's the end of Jacob's life, and he's blessing his sons. He's summing up their lives, and then he's telling them what's going to happen to their lineage in the future. This is what he says to Judah, and it has to do with this king that's being promised throughout Genesis. So it's Genesis chapter 49, verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So what he's saying here is that Judah's descendant will be this promised king. And this is the king that all of Genesis has been about when we think about it. The entire story of Genesis is about him. So this king, he'll be sacrificed for the sake of his brothers, just like Joseph was. Joseph was traded into slavery instead of his brothers. He'll be like that. This king will be the staircase from sinful men to a holy God, just like that staircase that Jacob had that dream about, the stairway to heaven. This king will be the one whose father will sacrifice him, the same way that Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac. This king will be the king of righteousness and peace without any beginning or end, the same way that Melchizedek was in Genesis. He'll be the mediator between God and man, the same way that Abraham was. He'll be the vessel that God carries sinful men above his judgment, the same way that Noah's ark was. And he'll be the one who finally crushes the snake underneath his feet, the way that we're promised in Genesis chapter 3. This is what we see in Genesis. The message of Genesis is that God will fulfill his promises to his people through Jesus Christ, who will be the King of Kings, who gives us God as a father, gives us a family, and will one day bring us into a home. Let's pray together.